Young, it's here and now. In a moment, our conversation about the forgotten war, Afghans increasingly feeling they're the collateral damage in the U.S. hunt for insurgents. But first, the investigation into allegations of politicization of the Justice Department widens today as the Senate hears testimony regarding the department's Civil Rights Division. Senators are interested in finding out why career lawyers with good performance ratings were transferred out of the Civil Rights Division over the objections of their immediate supervisors by Bradley Schlotzman, then Acting Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights. Schlotzman is no longer with the department. The Judiciary Committee is asking his replacement, Juan Kim, about their concerns that the firings were political and diluted the diversity of the division. The Justice Department is already under intense scrutiny for the firing of federal prosecutors. Kenneth Jost is Congressional Quarterly Editor and author of the Supreme Court A to Z. Kenneth, division lawyers are saying that the whole tone of their office has changed. They once enjoyed a collegial work environment free of partisanship. Has the office changed perceptibly?
Well, the Civil Rights Division has undergone a major transformation under the Bush administration, dating from 2001. Civil rights, traditional race-related civil rights cases, have been de-emphasized. Assistant Attorney General Juan Kim told House Judiciary Subcommittee earlier this year that they've emphasized religious discrimination cases much more. And the lawyers who came to Civil Rights Division to handle a particular kind of case have been, to some extent, shunted to the side.
In fact, division lawyers claim to have heard Bradley Schlotzman boast of his political leanings. What are some of the things he's said to have said?
He is alleged to have said of one Civil Rights Division lawyer, can we trust him? He didn't even vote for Bush. Mm-hmm. He has said of others that they weren't loyal Bushies. We'll hear questions about it today, and Assistant Attorney General Kim will have to reply.
He's also said to have said that his real motive in moving these career litigators out was he wanted to make room for good Americans. He uses the phrase "people on our team." He asked the division if they could trust someone else, because that person had voted for then-Bush rival John McCain. What has he said in the past in response to this?
To the extent that he was asked about his Civil Rights Division tenure, he insisted that no decisions were made on anything other than law, not on politics.
He's since left the division.
He's now in a second-ranking position in the Executive Office of U.S. Attorneys.
Yeah. Now, what about outgoing Deputy Attorney General Paul McNulty? Alberto Gonzalez is number two man in the Justice Department. When he last testified, he said the White House was not involved in the firings of attorneys general last December. He's had prepared testimony. Is that still his story?
No, he's slightly changing his story. He is telling the House subcommittee that the White House was more involved than he had earlier realized. He will insist that he's insisting that he had no intention to mislead Congress, and he's there to set the record straight. Obviously, in particular, the Democrats on the subcommittee will press him very, very closely and try to ascertain whether there are more contradictions that may emerge from today's hearing.
So the investigation so far is into the firing of U.S. prosecutors, into the firing of litigators at the Civil Rights Division. Is there a sense that it's going to broaden further?
There is a separate investigation of possible political hiring in the Justice Department's Honors Program. That is a program for the best and the brightest among recent law school graduates, and has always been a major source of Justice Department hiring, for a long-term basis. And the politicization of that program, or at least the alleged politicization, has been a source of great concern within the department, and a group of lawyers anonymously sent allegations to the Hill, and those allegations are being investigated internally by the Office of Inspector General and the Office of Professional Responsibility. So there are multiple investigations going on. Even if Attorney General Gonzalez remains in his post, Congress will continue to poke at this.
Kenneth Jost, Congressional Quarterly Editor and author of the Supreme Court A to Z, thanks so much.
Glad to be here.
Well, our conversation today is about what seems to be at times the forgotten war in Afghanistan, which is seeing a spike in violence. A landmine killed a NATO soldier and wounded four others in eastern Afghanistan today. Yesterday, three Canadian soldiers were killed by a bomb in Kandahar province. The violence in Afghanistan is increasing as both militants and U.S.-led foreign troops fight over the five-year-old pro-Western government. An estimated 2,400 people, including an increasing number of civilians, have died in the fighting this year in Afghanistan. Sarah Sewell is director of the Carr Center on Human Rights Policy at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. We thought we'd settle in with her for a few minutes. Her recent op-ed on Afghanistan appeared in the Boston Globe, and she joins us now to talk about it. Welcome, Sarah.
Thanks, Robin. Nice to be here.
Well, you know, first of all, characterize for us what you think is going on. We'd been told that with the spring thaws in Afghanistan, the Taliban would have resurgence, fighting season would begin. A NATO spokeswoman says, yes, fighting season is on. But she's characterized it and the recent spate of suicide bombings in particular as militarily insignificant. Do you agree?
I don't think we would be seeing the offensives on the part of the U.S. and NATO if we thought that Taliban activities were militarily insignificant. I think this is a particularly challenging season, and it's also an increasingly challenging time for ISAF, the International Security Force, and for the independent U.S. chain of command as it tries to wrestle this insurgency to the ground.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we're getting conflicting reports as to what kind of insurgency it is. The AP writes that the recent ground offensive in the south, now that may be what's important, that it's in the south, was a change in Taliban tactics from bombings and other attacks. But the New York Times wrote yesterday that Taliban insurgents have shifted tactics to terrorist tactics in part of a reaction to the development of an Afghan army. But what is happening? I mean, it feels as if there is an increase in suicide bombings.
I think the data bear that out. I think both things are happening at the same time. And one of the maddening things about insurgencies in general is how diverse they are across geographic areas, and what can work as a counterinsurgency tactic in one area can utterly fail in another, and the insurgents tend to adapt faster than their opponents can respond. So I think we'll continue to see this evolving mosaic of attacks and counterattack and non-attacking responses to Taliban activities.
So just to be clear, we're seeing sort of a ground offensive in the south, but also an increase in suicide bombings.
I think that's fair.
Yeah. Well, and also you say diverse. We have an image in our mind's eye, some of us, of who the Taliban are. They're the elders with beards and turbans that were governing Afghanistan. But we also read in the Times that their motivation isn't really clear, and they're not homogenous. That they include ideologically driven fighters, foreigners, criminals, poppy growers. I mean, who is the Taliban right now?
Any insurgency is going to attract a number of fellow travelers. There's going to be a degree of diversification of the fight. The definition of the Taliban itself has changed over time. The Taliban have adopted in Afghan tradition allies that have been somewhat antithetical to them. They've formed partnerships of convenience. It will depend on where you're fighting, who the Taliban is or who the insurgency is.
Yeah.
And it's a huge change to stay on top of for both NATO and the U.S.
And how bad is it? I mean, as we continue to just get the picture from you, just tell us right off the top, is Afghanistan in danger of becoming Iraq? Is it just a rough patch? Is it where is it?
I'm of the firm opinion that with the right series of steps and investment on the part of the international community and the United States, Afghanistan is a country that can still stabilize on Afghan terms, not on our terms, but on Afghan terms. It is not at risk of becoming Iraq right now. If we don't attend to it properly and respond appropriately, it will undoubtedly become a more complicated situation.
Yeah.
But I don't think that hope is lost there. And I think part of the struggle in the minds of the West is, are we going to continue to forget Afghanistan? Are we going to recognize that quite apart from what happens in Iraq, Afghanistan deserves attention and deserves resources and deserves a meeting of the minds in how to go about confronting the challenge there and supporting the Karzai government such that we can make a difference before it becomes as intractable as Iraq appears to be today.
And by the way, when you say Afghanistan on its own terms, just give, you know, what do you mean by
that? Afghanistan has proved ungovernable in ways that Americans would recognize.
For decades.
for an extremely long time, and one could argue that any semblance to the contrary was a purely artificial device. So stability in Afghanistan is really a misnomer to some degree. It probably means more of a workable federalism with differing degrees of security and differing political arrangements within them. But the core of a central government that functions and that can lay some claim to sovereignty and can, for our purposes, provide a degree of stability in terms of policing what happens inside that country is really got to be the baseline for us. But we have to accept that many of the compromises that will exist in terms of government structures, in terms of the mode of reconciling citizenry and religion, all of those will look very different from the choices we would make at home.
You write that there's an uneasy mix of counterinsurgency and counterterrorism at play right now. It's one of the problems you see in Afghanistan. Make the distinction.
Counterinsurgency is fundamentally about protecting civilians. The core tenet of the new counterinsurgency doctrine that the Army and the Marine Corps just released last December.
Written by the now commanding officer in Iraq, David Petraeus.
David Petraeus and General Mattis, Marine Corps General Mattis, were the key architects of that doctrine.
And Conrad Crane, who we just had on the program this week, was also lead author on that. So tell
Conrad
us.
Conrad did a phenomenal job wrestling that one to the ground. The central tenet of the counterinsurgency doctrine is really the centrality of the civilian and the need to protect the civilian. So unlike fighting a conventional war where your main aim is to destroy your enemy, in counterinsurgency, the main aim is to protect the civilian and provide security such that the host government can enhance its legitimacy. Counterterrorism is about focusing on the enemy. It's not defensive in nature. It's not about security in nature. It's primarily offensive, and the goal and the metric, if you will, is destroying terrorist capability. The stability that one wants and the protection for civilians that one wants in counterinsurgency is in tension with the offensive focus and the kinetic focus on destruction in counterterrorism. And that's what we see in tension in Afghanistan.
It's what you call counterinsurgency light, fewer boots on the ground. And you say that it's destroying rather than building Afghanistan, leading to the deaths of more civilians there. But as you write, there's political reticence to putting more boots on the ground, especially U.S. boots, and there's maybe a lack of resources. So what happens now? We're speaking with Sarah Sewell, Program Director at the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. We'll have more with Sarah in just a moment. This quick reminder, later in the program, still to come, there's that standoff in New Hampshire. A couple there convicted of not paying their taxes, refusing to give themselves up, and they're joined now in their standoff by Randy Weaver, he of the bloody Ruby Ridge Massacre. More after a break, here and now. It's here and now. We're back with Sarah Sewell of the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard. And Sarah, I want to clarify what Afghans perceive the U.S. is doing in Afghanistan. You say what the U.S. sees as counterinsurgency, which includes protecting civilians, Afghans feel is counterterrorism, where there's necessary collateral damage, and it's them. You mentioned repeated wedding party incidents. Remind us what you mean by that.
We've had wedding party incidents from really the beginning of this conflict, in which attacks on U.S. forces or alleged attacks on U.S. forces caused by gunfire in the context of wedding celebrations in Afghan tradition have been the justification for the use of force against these compounds that have ultimately killed women and children by the scores.
We heard about this in Iraq, but you're saying in Afghanistan.
In Afghanistan, the very first demonstrations against President Karzai in Kabul were by virtue of the repetition of these wedding party incidents. It's not the raids on these compounds happen, and particularly in the provinces where the Taliban are active and their families live, and that's where, of course, the Taliban take refuge when they're trying to hide from us. And they have no shame at all about placing their families at risk by so doing. But they put U.S. forces in a position where if they believe they have intelligence about arms caches, about training grounds, about the location of key leaders, they're basically diving blind into compounds that they may or may not know what's inside of.
Right. And, you know, you say that the gunfire that may have come from a compound may just have been a celebratory, you know, shooting of guns after a wedding. But it sounds like you're also talking about another issue that you write about, is that Americans were very slow to realize that they were being hijacked by unreliable Afghan intelligence, that they were just helping other people settle scores. And it took a long time for them. Is that still happening?
I think the problem is somewhat reduced now as we have grown to learn more about who's who in the country. I think our intelligence is better. I think our human intelligence is better. I think our relationships with Afghan security forces in some cases are much better. But one is always at risk in a nation that one doesn't understand, particularly when so relatively few members of the Western forces, whether ISAF or the U.S., have the language capabilities that one would need, let alone the depth of personal relationships that one would need to really have trust. One's always at risk for being, in effect, hijacked by unreliable allies and partners of the moment. And again, we are overstretched in terms of our troop presence. We can't stay in places that are of significant concern to us. We don't own the ground, as it were. We're in and out. And we're relying on those who nominally live there or know better than we do to direct us how to appropriately use our force. The ability for us to make mistakes in that reliance will never go away entirely.
So are you saying, I mean, we know that the U.S. has tried to get other countries to put more troops in Afghanistan. Are you saying that ultimately the only way to keep any kind of peace in Afghanistan is to put more U.S. troops there?
We need more troops. They don't necessarily have to be U.S. troops, but I think our NATO allies have been walking the walk for a while, and they really don't have much more capacity to provide. That's a separate discussion and a problem in the context of a struggle against terrorism globally. But I do think that if the U.S. is unable to invest more by way of increasing security for civilians, not just to help the civilians and legitimize the central government, but also to be able to do all of the other non-military pieces of counterinsurgency work, the sewage and the water and the schools and the hospitals, all the hearts and mind pieces that can only happen effectively in a secure environment. If you can't provide the security on the ground with people such that it's sustained the minute the operation ends, you're not going to be able to do the nuts and bolts of nation building.
It almost feels as if you conclude by saying that this blurring of goals in Afghanistan, you know, are we fighting terrorism or are we nation building, you know, which are we doing, is one of the problems, and that the U.S. may have to sort of give up on the pursuing the counterinsurgence part and be more of a nation. You know, it's what are you saying?
Because I'm saying is that people who believe that there's a forcible solution to the terrorist problem in Afghanistan, I think are at risk of misunderstanding the political circumstances in which they are operating. We are there with the consent and support of the Karzai government. If our pursuit of terrorists makes it politically untenable for that government to welcome and be supportive of our presence, we can't fight it all. So you may have to, in effect, ratchet down your offensive piece and make it more discriminate and controlled than you would want in an unconstrained environment in order to be able to pursue it. Military officer emailed me about how this piece rang true for him. He talked about the choices that they made in 2004 to specifically ratchet down on the kinetic part of operations and focus on the security pieces and the nation-building pieces, and that choice was made because they recognized that the political capital that you have to conduct operations that result in collateral damage is a finite amount that you must spend carefully over time in order to pursue the more important goals that you have on the kinetic side. And he worries that the current approach has forgotten that important lesson.
Right. If you lose the people because they increasingly are collateral damage while you go after the Taliban, then it doesn't matter if you've caught some Taliban because
well,
you've lost
look,
the people.
We've just talked about the need to have a representative democracy. And if you just put yourselves in the shoes of Afghans for a moment and you think about the fact that you want the government to be responsive to civilian needs, if the civilians perceive that the Western pursuit of security is jeopardizing their own security, then democratic governance will kick out the forces that are making people feel insecure. We can't have our
cake
and eat it too.
Which is the U.S. Which is the U.S.
We need to calibrate our objectives and recognize that they are at odds and in tension and make choices that will allow us, perhaps not perfectly, but realistically, to continue to pursue terrorists and create the stability that we want in Afghanistan. But if we don't see the relationship and if we're not willing to accept the realities of the circumstance, we may find we can do neither of those objectives. Hmm. And that will be the worst of all possible worlds.
Sarah Sewell, director at the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. You can read her op-ed on Afghanistan by going to our website, here-now.org. Sarah, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Robin.
Okay, after the news, the standoff in New Hampshire, here and now.
Support
Young, it's here and now. Ed and Elaine Brown of Plainfield, New Hampshire, have a new houseguest, white supremacist Randy Weaver, who gained notoriety and lost his wife and son when he refused to surrender to U.S. Marshals for a court appearance in his bloody standoff at Idaho's Ruby Ridge in 1992. A U.S. Marshal was also killed in that incident. Weaver is now lending his support to the Browns' standoff with federal marshals, who are charged with arresting the couple after they were convicted of tax evasion. The Browns took refuge on their 110-acre home 5 months ago. Reporter Margot Sanger-Katz has been following the story for the Concord Monitor, and she joins us from the studios of New Hampshire Public Radio. Hi, Margot.
Hello.
Let's start with, who are Ed and Elaine Brown? What's their cause, their complaint?
Well, I think they have several complaints. Ed Brown said that he has been very suspicious of the federal government. In the mid-1990s, he became a leader of a local militia here. But they have sort of come into the most contact with the government due to their views about the federal tax code. They are believers in a movement called the tax protest, or sometimes the tax honesty movement. And basically, they believe that federal tax law does not require most ordinary Americans to pay income taxes. Mm-hmm. They think that this is part of a large government conspiracy to keep people from finding this out. And so they decided about 10 years ago that they were going to stop paying their taxes, and this was going to be a way of testing the system.
Right. They've each been convicted and sentenced to more than 5 years in federal prison for this, thinking that taxes aren't in the Constitution, they're unconstitutional, and they've now become the darlings of the anti-government, patriot, anti-tax movement. And into their drama comes Randy Weaver. His standoff in 1992 was over his failure to appear in court on a gun charge. He eventually served a 16-month prison sentence for not showing up in court, but he was cleared of any charges in deaths that resulted in that shootout at Ruby Ridge. He'd been living pretty quietly, we understand, in Arkansas and Iowa, raising three daughters, avoiding the spotlight. How did he get involved here and now?
He really got involved because other people in the Patriot movement thought that he would be an important person to kind of bring out and support the Browns. And so he was approached on one internet radio show and asked if he would consider coming to New Hampshire. And initially he said, you know, I'd love to come, but I don't have the money. And so the radio host actually put together some money and then found some other radio hosts who were willing to drive him from a home in Arkansas where he was staying to the Browns' house this weekend.
Which brings us to the press conference that the Browns and Weaver held just after Weaver arrived. You described it in your writing as contentious. It also seemed really odd. I mean, at one point, Mr. Brown has been accused of being anti-Semitic, speaking about some sort of Zionist cabal. And he responded by telling a black reporter that he would wash the black reporter's feet.
Yes, it was very strange. I think that Ed Brown was a little bit frustrated with the press. I think he was not happy that he was being asked so many tough questions. And there were several outbursts where he criticized members of the press for not doing their homework, for not being critical enough of the government. And then there was this sort of strange moment where a reporter asked Ed whether he was uncomfortable with Randy Weaver's white separatist background. And Ed sort of responded by saying, you know, I love all of mankind. And then he singled out this one black television reporter who was there and said, you know, you're welcome to come stay in my home and I will wash your feet. It was an interesting moment.
Well, and it also involved Randy Weaver, who, again, had lost his wife and son who were killed at Ruby Ridge. Tell us about his response. I know he held up a photo of his wife.
He did. He held up a photo of his wife holding one of his daughters. And as you may know, when his wife was shot, she actually was holding their youngest daughter in her arms, who I think was a very young infant at the time. And, you know, there was real emotion in the way that he told the story about what had happened to him and his family. He sort of, his voice broke at a few moments. Hmm. It was a very dramatic story, I think.
He also said he wasn't afraid of dying anymore, and then talked again about his thoughts about the government. Let's listen to a little of what Randy Weaver said.
Every government destroys itself. This one's doing it right now to themselves. And it's not my fault. They lied to me. They shot up my family. I didn't ask for that. I sure as heck didn't want that. You wouldn't want that. The average person wouldn't want that. But most people will pay their taxes because they're scared not to. That's why, fear. That's how they control people. Fear of hell and fear of dying and going to hell because you didn't pay your taxes. What a joke.
That's Randy Weaver, again, speaking on a porch in New Hampshire. And the Browns, the people that he's come to support, spoke as well, as we said. Here's Elaine Brown speaking with reporters about what she sees as the options that she and her husband face.
We are right. We have committed no crime. So they're either going to have to let us go free to go about our lives, or they're going to have to come in here and try and take us, in which case we will defend to the death.
Margot, you know, to the death. And as we know, they're standing with Randy Weaver, and that did happen to him. Federal marshals have cut power and phone lines to the Browns' home. They're attempting to block cell phone access. But Marshal Stephen Monier says he's determined to be patient. He's going to wait out the Browns. He's negotiating a settlement. But now Randy Weaver is there. We understand town officials are concerned. So how much longer do you think this can go on?
I think it's a very hard question to answer. Monier has said from the very beginning that his plan has been not to initiate any violence, not to go to the house, and just to sort of be patient and try to convince the Browns to turn themselves in. But on June 7th, there was this huge buildup of police forces, including multiple SWAT teams, an explosives disposal unit, a helicopter. People were ordered out of the airspace over the home. And the marshal says that he was not going to arrest the Browns, but I think the Browns feel that the marshal's been dishonest and that this was really an aborted attempt to arrest, or sometimes they say kill them.
So how are the Browns reacting to this now?
So far, the Browns have remained relatively resolute. They have continued to make threats and to be pretty strong in their statements about both the taxes and their continued belief in their legal views, and also in their willingness to die and to be engaged in a Ruby Ridge-like standoff.
Is there any sense, though? I mean, the Browns have been described as media savvy. Is there a way of determining, you know, how much is real and how much of it is for show? They're also protesting, you know, going to jail for the next 5 years.
I think it's very difficult to say. I mean, there's some evidence that maybe the rhetoric is overblown. Ed Brown has made some very strong statements in the past. On the other hand, you know, he has made some pretty serious threats. I think there's evidence that he's well-armed. And he's also attracted the attention and the support of a lot of people.
Well, this is what has Selectmen in Plainfield worried. They've sent the marshal a letter saying, please hurry up and arrest the Browns because, you know, we have a small police force. It's stressed here. We're afraid of what's going to happen, you know, to surrounding residents. The Browns' refuge, their home, is, you know, quite a setup. They've got, you know, 8-inch concrete walls, a turret with a 360-degree view, solar power, wind power, geothermal. It sounds as if the Browns have been preparing for a while for this standoff. I know you described an image that you have of him at the front door.
You know, it really was quite a scene. Ed Brown has taken to wearing a pistol tucked into the back of his pants, and he also wears the badge of the Constitution Rangers, which is one of the anti-government groups that he is involved in. And, you know, just very angry and frustrated, I think, with the press and with the public, I think, for not really rallying to his cause and seeing his point of view. I think he likes to think of himself as being a leader, and he's been frustrated.
Margot Sanger-Katz reports for the Concord Monitor on the standoff up in New Hampshire between the Brown family, who've been convicted for tax evasion, their supporter, Randy Weaver of Ruby Ridge fame, and U.S. Marshals. Margot, thanks so much.
Oh, you're very welcome.
I should say Ruby Ridge notoriety. Still to come before the hour's over, food for a Stone Soul picnic and music, too. You're listening to Here and Now. In a unanimous ruling, the Supreme Court decided today that athletic associations can enforce limits on schools recruiting high school athletes, and to do so doesn't violate coaches' free speech rights. This came from a lawsuit brought by Brentwood Academy, a private high school in Tennessee, against that state's High School Athletic Association. And here to tell us more about that and the rest of the news from the world of sports, Only a Game host Bill Littlefield. Nice to see you as always.
It's always fun to be here.
Let's go to this case. It was over some letters that the private school coach sent to some middle school players inviting them to spring training. For many of us, this is sort of an eye-opener. I didn't realize there was that much recruiting on the high school level.
Well, there is certainly recruiting on the high school level. A lot of times it involves things like kids and their parents fudging addresses, residential addresses, so they can get into one school district where the high school coach will be better for their future career, that sort of thing. This is a curious case because it doesn't seem to me to really be about recruiting at all. The letters were sent by a coach to a bunch of eighth grade kids who'd already enrolled in the school. So he wasn't trying to lure them from another school. The reason the case occurred, I think, was so that the association, the state association, could assert its authority. And the reason the Supreme Court ruled the way it did, I guess, is because they didn't want to upset the authority. They want the state association to be the ruling body on these sort of things rather than individual schools being able to decide these sort of things for themselves.
Okay. Well, there was other legal news this week, big news, in a story we've been following, the Duke lacrosse rape case. The North Carolina State Legislature gave final approval to a bill directing Governor Mike Easley to remove Mike Nifon, the Durham district attorney at the center of the case. We all remember he was disbarred, suspended from his job for lying to the court, making inflammatory statements about the players accused, as it turns out, falsely of rape. He's offered to leave July 13th. Earlier this week, the lacrosse players reached an undisclosed settlement with the school. Is this story, at least in, you know, that context, over?
The charges against the players have been dismissed. The word innocent has been bandied about by all parties concerned, and Mr. Nifong has been punished and publicly ridiculed. And so in that respect, yes, this is over. I don't know to what extent the inclination of Duke lacrosse players to hire dancers and trade racial insults with them will change, but I suppose we'll see in the future.
Because that much, as reported, did happen. Well, on a happier note, maybe, Texas Ranger slugger Sammy Sosa became only the fifth player in baseball to hit 600 home runs in his career. Barry Bonds did it against his former team, the Chicago Cubs, but there's still a bit of a steroid cloud around Sosa.
Well, I think there always will be. I don't think that there are going to be final answers on these sorts of things. And ultimately, I think people are simply going to have to decide that this is a chapter that occurred in Major League Baseball. And maybe they clap with only one hand when Barry Bonds breaks Henry Aaron's record. But, you know, you can't pretend that the logical thing to do is punish only the very best guys who broke the rules, because how are you going to figure out who else broke the rules?
By the way, I just want to make sure I was clear. I meant Barry Bonds did it against Sosa's former team.
Well, Sosa did it against his former team. Sosa used to play for the Cubs. He hit the home run, the 600th home run against the Cubs. Bonds, we don't know who he's going to do it against when he breaks Henry Aaron's record. That's still a few home runs away.
That's what I meant.
There you go.
Okay, moving on. We must end on a lighter note. From the world of fashion and hockey, we get a look at the new uniforms. I'm looking. These are new uniforms that the National Hockey League is hoping will revitalize some interest in the sport.
Absolutely.
They're said to be sleeker and faster. I'm looking at one on the front page of the Boston Globe here, the Boston Bruins. It looks like the old Boston Bruins.
The words svelte and sleek don't leap to mind, Robin?
No.
I don't understand. One of the players interviewed said he was 8% faster in the new uniform, so I have to take his word for it that the NHL will be putting a faster, sleeker product on the ice next season.
Well, they are throwing out percentages. 76% less moisture.
And 61% more protection to the hip, which was, you know, hey, how can that be bad?
I'd like to have that. Only Game host Bill Littlefield, thanks as always for coming by.
My pleasure.
Phew. Still to come, music and food for the summer. After the break, here and now. Young, it's here and now. Summer begins today. Lazy days at the beach, warm nights under the stars, maybe a picnic.
Can you surrey? Can you picnic? Whoa, can you surrey? Can you picnic? Come on, come on and surrey.
How about a stoned soul picnic? And by stoned, we simply mean an enjoyable one. This is courtesy of Laura Nero. I guess Surrey Down is the dance. And here now is jazz aficionado James Isaacs is spreading his blanket and spreading the good news of summer tunes. James, welcome as always.
Hi, Robin. How are you?
Good. Surrey Down was a dance, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's, I think, a kind of a slow and easy dance
That's right.
A nice, warm summer afternoon.
This is a great pick.
Oh,
love
yeah.
this song. It got overplayed in its day, but now you love it.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely.
Well, and since this is our seasonal pairing of our two favorite people, we also have here now resident chef Kathy Gunst. Happens to be a huge Laura Nero fan, so that works
huge.
As well.
Huge. I'm loving listening to that. How can you be in a bad mood and listen to that
That's
song?
Right. Kathy, when I think picnics and summer, you know, we of course think lighter fare. I'm sure you feel the same way.
Absolutely. We are done with the soups and stews of winters. My garden is already producing beautiful salads. I've been having a lot of fun putting together lots of different types of lettuce and adding fresh herbs to it. I've also become a big fan of taking nuts, which are very good for you, and sauteing them really lightly in a little bit of olive oil and then drizzling a really good honey over it so they become glazed.
Is that after you saute them? You take them out?
No, you saute them. They're in the pan. They're hot. You drizzle the honey on into the hot pan. It sizzles up. It creates this beautiful glaze, crumbling different kinds of cheeses, blues, goat cheese. Also, if you've roasted a chicken or if you've barbecued something, you slice it up and put it on all those greens with these walnuts and cheese. And dinner's looking good and simple.
Well, James,
yes, Robin.
Give us something else that just, you know, can awaken our senses to summer.
Well, let me think about this. I've tried to avoid the obvious in our summer musical choices, so for that reason you won't hear Summertime. You won't hear Summer in the City or Summertime Blues. But you will hear next a wonderful tune, and, well, most people know Frank Sinatra's 1966 original of The Summer Wind. But last year, Madeline Peru came out with a lovely version of The Summer Wind. It's been widely remarked upon that Madeline Peru uses Billie Holiday-esque inflections and phrasings, but I love the sound of her voice, and I think that her performance of one of Johnny Mercer's most memorable lyrics speaks for itself. Her version stands with any version of Summer Wind.
The summer wind came blowing in from across the sea. Lingered there, so warm and fair, to walk with me. All summer long, we sang a song and strolled on golden sand. Two sweethearts and the summer wind.
James, I'm right on track with you here today. This is music I love.
Yeah, it's real pretty.
She has a gorgeous voice.
Uh-huh.
And loving is one thing, but what does it inspire you to present to us?
Well, I would like to present a drink for you. Summertime, living
is
easy, a libation. First off, this is the simplest drink, but it's got three key elements. The first really fun element is I took a leaf of fresh mint, put it into an ice cube tray and froze it, and you have these adorable little green mint ice cubes.
Look at that.
Next, I made a syrup. It is called a simple sugar syrup. One part sugar, one part water. Boil it, lower the temperature, simmer it for 5 minutes. That's it. I added grated lemon zest and fresh mint from the garden. So this is a lemon mint syrup. We're going to add about a tablespoon or two to each glass. And we're going to top it off with some fresh squeezed lime juice and seltzer. And there you have a lime Ricky, so it's got the lemon mint syrup, fresh lime juice, seltzer, and obviously you could pop some rum in there if you were so inclined. And cheers.
Here's to summer.
Here's to summer.
Well, Robin, you know, summer means fun, as the Beach Boys once limned in song many decades ago. But sometimes, as in all of the other seasons of the year, summer can mean heartbreak. And Brian Wilson, when he was, I guess, about 21 years old, wrote one of the most heartbreakingly beautiful ballads, I guess set in the summer because it's called The Warmth of the Sun. Then again, in Southern California, it's almost always summer, so who knows? Now, an interesting sidelight to this, in fact, a sadder sidelight to this, is that Brian Wilson wrote this song only hours after President Kennedy was assassinated. The song still has a very optimistic ending because, as he sings, the love of my life has left me today, etc., etc. But at the end, he sings, but I've got the warmth of the sun within me tonight.
I'll dream.
You're so right. There's a melancholy about something,
yes,
because you always feel like it's almost over.
Well, the minute it starts,
right?
Yeah.
It's almost over. So, Kathy, speaking of which, the ending, dessert.
Dessert. The strawberries are coming. The cherries are coming. Soon we'll have peaches and nectarines. I mean, there's nothing better than picking a fresh, warm berry from the vine and popping it in your mouth. But one of the really great, fun desserts of summer is to take fruit, put it into a food processor, blend it with a little bit of water and sugar. Now, we could do this with watermelon, peaches, blueberries. And then you just put it into like a brownie tray, this pureed fruit with a little bit of water and sugar, pop it in the freezer. Every hour, go get a fork and just grind it up, right? You're going to flake it up, and you're going to have an Italian ice at the end, a fresh fruit Italian ice. And that will take the summer blues away for sure.
Okay. Well, James, we went through the lows of summer, the melancholy.
Yeah.
We've been through it already. We're feeling better.
I know, it's over. Give us some of the highs.
Well, to me, one of the highs of summer is this song. It's not terribly well known, but it's a beauty. It's called That Sunday, That Summer. And we hear it done by a man who should have been much better known in his life. His name, Bobby Scott. He was born in 1937, died in 1990. This song really is a little gem with a sublimely winding melody, recalling the joys of new love on a gorgeous Sunday afternoon in a bucolic setting. And Bobby Scott's smoky voice is one of a kind.
The day that I met you, newborn whippoorwills were calling from the hills. Summer was a-coming in but fast. Lots of daffodils were showing off their skills. Nodding all together, I could almost hear them whisper, go on, kiss her, go on and kiss her.
I'm hearing that song, imagining lying on a blanket, a bowl of cherries, and Lime Ricky was someone you really like to talk to. That would be a good summer afternoon.
Let's get out of here. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org. And while you're there, you can download a podcast of any show. We've been talking summer food and music with Here and Now's jazz aficionado James Isaacs and resident chef Kathy Gunst. Kathy and James, as always, thank you both.
Best season of the year, Robin. Great to be here.
I'm with you, James. Best season for me, too.
That Sunday, that summer.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.